be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, people, and keep up to date via iTunes and Facebook and Twitter. And I'm Jono. Joining me, of course, is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day to you too.
Before we kick off today, my friend, because we are in 1 Samuel chapter 18, having finally worked through the most exciting chapter, which is David and Goliath in chapter 17, there's a couple of questions. Can we do a little bit of Q&A before we get into Light of the Prophets?
Yeah, we can. And by the way, I want to thank everyone for the really good feedback, the very positive feedback for the previous episode. I think this was a very exciting episode. I think it's one of the most interesting, most exciting stories in the Bible.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And it was pretty surprising because I got personal messages from people saying it was a good one. So I want to thank everyone for the feedback. It's very encouraging. So it's very, very good.
And also
I want to thank everyone for praying for my dad.
Yes.
Things haven't changed with him yet. But my wife is getting better. She's feeling better now. She's back eating, which is good. She has more energy.
Wonderful.
And now I just have to get rid of this massive headache of renovating this apartment up north in the Galilee.
Yeah.
All the pressure is on my head.
Now that you've mentioned that, and we do thank the listeners for praying in regards to Yoel's father and also for his wonderful wife, and if they would continue to do so. But you're the Levite in Jerusalem, then you're the Levite in the desert. Now you're planning on being the Levite where?
In the Galilee.
In the Galilee. So if all goes to plan, and nothing ever goes to plan, but if it does go to plan, how soon do you think you might be there?
So we actually started work a couple of weeks ago, but we had to clear out the place before we actually did any work. So I actually had to throw out some memories as well because it was, you know, so much there.
This is the old family home, right?
This is the old family home, and I can share part of the story. I mean, when I was 17, almost 18, my parents left Israel to the United States, and I stayed back because I felt this powerful urge to stay loyal to the land and stay in Israel. And for about 4 years, my home was basically a backpack where I carried all my clothing and all my stuff, and any of the books I had were left with friends. And when we got married, I gathered all the books from different friends and put them all together in my library. But for about 4 years, my backpack was my home. And
you were a wild man in the mountains of Israel.
Yeah, I had a long beard back then.
Yeah,
very long beard. Now the house stood empty for a very, very long time. My parents never really wanted to sell this. And it was actually a very smart thing that they did that, because today the situation of housing here in Israel is very, very problematic. And more and more people are moving out of the city into places which are cheaper. They're not like, you know, centralized areas, but it's cheaper. Mm. And the town I grew up in, which is near Haifa, which is in the western side of the Galilee, the southwest Galilee, is a nice town. I grew up there. I lived there for many, many years. And now we just have to renovate the place. We actually had a scare when we walked in, because we discovered the floor in the living room has to be resupported, and we actually have an engineer coming in. But he received a description of what's happened there, and his immediate response was, you have to do something. But he said he'll come, and I'm meeting up with him tomorrow, and he's going to give me exact detail of what has to be done. Yeah, it's better than having to buy a house. So you spend some money on this, some money on that. Yeah. We're not talking about a fixer-upper. We're talking about a full renovation of the house. Mm-hmm. But it's cheaper. It's actually cheaper and easier to do this than actually buy a house. Mm. So it means that, you know, one big expense less. Mm-hmm. Which is a plus as far as I see it. But again, it's not Jerusalem area, you know. It means that if I want to meet up with anyone that comes to visit Israel, they either have to come to the Haifa area or I have to travel out to Jerusalem.
Because
it's
a couple of hours drive, isn't it?
You can get from the town I'm moving to. Can actually, if you drive on Road 6, you can actually get to Jerusalem in about, my guess is, 2 hours. So it's not that far away. I mean, Israel is a very, very small place. So nothing's really far away. The only place that's really far away is Eilat. Eilat is like far away from everything.
Sure. Sure. But I remember, Yoel, when I was there, we did travel up with Keith Johnson and the 3T Tour. We traveled all the way up to the Galilee and Tel Dan. I remember we went as far as Tel Dan. And my goodness, the countryside is beautiful up there.
Yeah, so the guys who are doing the renovation work are actually these really, really, really friendly Bedouin guys who serve in the Israeli army and everything. These are not, you know, there's no Palestinians or anything. Really, I mean, every time I hear this thing about Galilean Arabs, you know, Arabs from the Galilee saying they're Palestinians, I turn around to one of them and said to him, you do know that about 10 years ago, your father pretty slapped you in the face for saying that. Because I know Arabs who live in the Galilee who 10, 15 years ago would try to probably kill you if you called them Palestinian.
Really? Is that right?
It's really the teenagers now who are saying this because it's like a rebellious thing and, you know, they're trying to find an identity. It's an identity crisis, but it's a little rubbish. Mm. They're Israeli citizens. They carry blue ID cards. Blue is your Israeli citizen. There's green and there's orange, and each one of them is something else. So orange and green has to do with the Palestinian Authority. Blue has to do with the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, so we sit around, we talk, and they actually gave me a ride. It's one of the first times, it's one of the very rare occasions I actually get in a car with someone who's actually technically an Arab. Mm-hmm. And they actually gave me a ride all the way to this other town. It's about half an hour to 45 minutes away. And we got there and we're driving through the Galilee. And I turn around to the driver, his name is Salah. And I say to him, I forgot how beautiful the Galilee is. And he says to me, yeah, it is, isn't it? He showed me where his village is, and he showed me his family's property, and we did the job of the mountain. He showed me different things I haven't seen in years. So it was pretty amazing, you know. And he said, you know, when if you ever come by, you know, pop by, we'll buy kosher food for you when you come over, really? And you bring your family. He's really, really friendly guy.
Yeah, very nice. Very kind.
Yeah. He and his brother are very, very nice people.
Well, it's a real blessing that you've got such people to work on the house while it's being prepared before you move in.
And they're very good workers. I mean, there's his brother, Adil. This guy can hustle work. This guy works. He comes in and like bang, 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 he's done.
and he does a good job.
So I'm very
such a blessing.
I'm blessed to have these guys working.
Indeed. So soon to be the Levite in the Galilee, and we'll look forward to talking to you when you are there, because I mean some of the areas around there and the historical significance, we'll definitely have conversations in regards to that. But we have questions from people. Yoel, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Hit me.
Right. Number one, people want to know, what happened to the pita bread ingredients and the recipe that you were going to send me?
I forgot about that. I have to openly admit that I completely and utterly forgot about that.
You got people's mouth watering over that one. Okay.
It's just, as you know, I have a lot going on.
You've got a lot going on.
I have to travel once a week to the Galilee to see the progress of work. Not only that it cost me a lot of money to do this travel back and forth and take the babysitters, it's also an issue of time. I went up one day just to sign a contract with the contractor, and I was out of the house for 8 hours because I had to do everything on bus. I don't have a car.
Once you are settled in your new...
You must forgive me.
Once you're settled in your new house... What we have to, I'm telling you, people would, I reckon, you know, I want to hear from the listeners on this. I haven't even floated the idea past you. But I reckon, because you did a video about pressing wine. You remember that?
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
Okay, so now, and that was great. And I think that people would love to have, every now and then, a short little cooking tip from Yoel. I mean, come on, because you've got a diploma, you're a chef, and I think, you know, some recipes, particularly some traditional recipes. I think people would really like to see that. If you get time when you move,
you can do that.
Could be a winner. All right, that's something to talk about later. But these are the other questions. There's been a lot of talk lately, Yoel, and a lot of questions. And I know this is really your kettle of fish, this topic, in regards to, and we have spoken about it before, in regards to tzitzit and the kippah. Now, when I was in Israel, you and I observed a more recent phenomenon, which was the micro tallit, the thing called the micro tallit, which is like a little purse that you wear on the side of your pants or whatever, and it had tzitzit on it. That's some sort of messianic phenomenon that's recently appeared. So a clever way for someone to make money, I think. But is it okay to wear a tzitzit on the belt loops of one's jeans, for example, or must we have a prayer shawl, a tallit?
Wow. Okay. So first of all, regarding the micro tallit, the Torah says you have to put a piece of clothing you wear. Mm-hmm. The micro tallit is just this thing you hang on your side. So with all due respect to the belts I've seen and the micro tallit and everything, it's not a piece of clothing. Torah says in the book of Deuteronomy, it says very clearly, "Gdilim ta'aseh lecha," braided fringes, or "gdilim" means something braided. You shall do for yourself, al arba kanfot kesutecha, on the four corners of your garment, asher techaseba, which you will cover yourself with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with all the respect to this thing, unless you put it on your head, it doesn't really cover anything. Or you put on your hand or something. It doesn't really cover your body.
It's an accessory.
It's talking about something. It's an accessory. It's like wearing a purse or something. So puts it on your purse. I mean, seriously.
It talks about a
garment that you cover yourself with, something you wear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the ancient world, and if you go to my Facebook page, my Hebrew and Israel Facebook page, you'll see this. There was a picture there of what people always write as a Canaanite, but seems to be an Israelite. The blue eyes, the color of the beard, the color of the skin shows it's a white Asian. So it's probably an Israelite.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of, I also have to say, this is kind of in the face of some people who claim that, you know, very white Jews are not really Jews and stuff like that, which is a lot of nonsense. Because you see this picture, this image from thousands of years ago of people who are officially called Canaanites, but they walk around with four fringes, you know, on their corners, mm-hmm. and they grow a beard and everything. That you see that these people are actually fair-skinned. Some of them are very light-colored. Some of them are darker.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say a garment, something you cover yourself with, it has to be your piece of clothing. Now, also the issue of where do you hang the tzitzit, which is also part of the question of, you know, can you put it on your trousers?
Mm.
So the word kanaf, we have in Numbers the word kanaf, which I usually explain as being the rim of your clothing, the skirt of your clothing, unlike what some people say, an actual, you know, four corners. You know, for example, a prayer shawl is a large square or rectangular piece of cloth with actual four corners.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the Greco-Roman period. Before that, they maybe wore things like that to cover themselves during the winter. But during the summer, men never wore shirts. Men only wore these skirts, these wrap-on skirts that they had.
Mm.
Either wrap-on skirts or somehow kind of a thing that they wore as a skirt.
Mm.
And usually they were very, very colorful. And the question is, how do you explain what the corners of your garment is? So if you say the same way I do, it's not an actual corner, but it's the skirt of your clothing, then the skirt means the corners, the ends of it. Now, what's very, very interesting from this image, and it's very, very important to remember that we have no actual proof that this is an Israelite. But based on the explanation that this is, that the word kanaf means a skirt or the rim,
mm-hmm.
then it can be any rim. So the top of your trousers, where the belt loops are, is the edge of that piece of clothing. So I would say, and I know I have friends who disagree with this, but I would say very clearly that you probably can put tzitzit on your belt loops.
Sure.
It's just the problem that we have psychologically with this is that we keep on thinking about, you know, the bottom end of your clothing hanging to the bottom.
Mm.
But what's very interesting with this image of this Canaanite is he has three on the bottom and they're more or less in front of him. And then he has one on the top just below his navel.
Mm-hmm.
He has one more fringe just below his navel. Now, obviously, if you were asking Orthodox, you'd say, oh, it's obvious this is not an Israelite because he's not following the practices we have today. But with all due respect, everyone knows that there's changes in religion and changes in practices throughout the centuries. So what they did back then won't be the same thing we do today. I mean, actually, tell the truth, we always have this joke that, you know, Moses came in and saw what we're doing today, probably start slapping us over the head and saying, what are you doing?
Probably.
So to me, it seems that you can put it on the belt loops. And I personally have a four corner garment. I just do what everyone else does because there's no point in being different. But essentially, I don't think there's a problem. So, for example, even if you have a skirt, if a woman wears her skirt, and I am of the opinion that women can wear tzitzit, which kind of annoyed a lot of people. Actually, someone turned around to me and said, so you're reform? And I said, no. There's no prohibition in the Torah, and even the Talmud, there's an opinion in the Talmud. Actually, the majority opinion of the opinion in the Talmud is actually that you can, I don't know if it's the majority opinion, because when it says Chachamim, it might be Rabbi Meir. But in any case, there's no clear prohibition that women can't wear tzitzit, and there's even some places where they said that women can wear tzitzit with, you know, as long as they don't say a blessing over it or something, because they don't have to wear tzitzit. Now, again, blessing, no blessing, doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Can women wear tzitzit? The answer is, even according to the Talmudic tradition, you can. A woman can wear tzitzit. Okay. So a woman who wears a skirt, does she have to put it at the bottom end of the skirt or the top end of the skirt? And I would say, either way, whatever you feel comfortable with.
Sure.
Look, if you put it on the bottom, you should make small ones that don't get ruined. Because some, for example, you know, there's a lot of women from different groups that they wear a very, very long skirt. And my wife does the same thing, and this is the Orthodox practice that women cover up. But some women, for example, if they wear below the knee, then below the knee, then it's easier. So, but I would say I think it's better to put on the top part.
Because you don't want them dragging in the dust, right?
It looks kind of funny.
Sure.
You know, most people wear the wet tzitzit, it's somewhere around their belt line, so it's a bit more reasonable. I would just hang off of your shirt, by the way. I just put it on my shirt, and that would be it.
So the question that then arises is, some people object to what you've said because they say there is no four corners on your, say you put your jeans on, where are the four corners? What are you talking about? But does not Isaiah talk about the four corners of the earth? I mean, where are the four corners of the earth?
No, it's beyond that. A corner, as I just said, a corner is not a corner. It's a side. So when it says four corners, it means four sides.
Uh-huh.
And the word kanaf, which is what your English would translate as the word corner, doesn't mean corner. It means a side.
Excellent.
The edge, the rim of something. So you have a shirt, it's round. You put one here, one in the back, one in the back. That's basically it.
Beautiful. Thank you, my friend. And so now we did talk about, just for listeners, you can find in more detail the discussion on women and the tzitzit. You'll have to put it in the search engine, or I'll put a link to it on this post. But Yoel and I did discuss that in a little bit more detail. The kippah, the traditional Jewish cap.
Okay, so I need 2 seconds to take care of something, because Prince Alevi IV is requesting my attention.
You do that.
He's pointing at his bottom, which means he probably needs a diaper change. It's pretty. I want to say something, and I wanted to leave this in the recording. He is probably one of the most intelligent kids I've ever seen. He doesn't talk that much, but boy, can he tell me what he wants.
He can communicate.
He communicates very, very well.
Something's going on down here in this region that I'm not sure about, is what he's saying.
Oh, I can tell you a funny story. There was one time when he runs into the room with this very, very concerned look on his face, and he's pointing out towards the bathroom. And he's going, a really concerned look on his face. And it looked as if he said, "Listen, I think you should come over and see this. Something's wrong." And what he was pointing out was the fact that his older brother, who was about, you know, probably about 2.5, almost 3, mm-hmm. went to the potty and didn't flush the toilet. And he just saw something he's never seen before in that. So it was like, it was just funny. He runs up to me and goes, Yeah, I'm coming, honey.
Let's go and deal with Prince Alevi IV, and we'll just wait here for you.
Okay, just a second.
Oh, dear me. So while we're waiting, boys and girls, I'm just going to look it up now. There it is. Beautiful. Okay, so it's 1 Samuel chapter 9. You'll find it on Light of the Prophets. 1 Samuel chapter 9, 25 through to 10:27. We did begin that particular episode of Light of the Prophets with the question, should women wear tzitzit? So you'll find it there. But I will put a link on this post in regards to a link on this post for that episode, so that you can listen to that there as well, should you have a particular interest in this topic. So that deals with that topic, but the kippah. Now, I've got a couple of kippahs. I've got, believe it or not, I've got a blue suede kippah from the synagogue in Canberra that was given to me. That was very nice. And I bought one. I bought another one when I was in Israel. I also have, my sons have an IDF kippah, which they thought was pretty cool. But generally, I just sort of, I like to wear hats, and I wear a cap, or I wear, you and I have similar caps. You've got your Guinness tweed cap that you got when you were in England last. And And so, you know, when I go somewhere that is traditionally required to, expected to wear a kippah, I'm probably more inclined to wear my cap. But is it absolutely necessary to wear a kippah all the time?
This practice developed in different ways. Okay, so first of all, no. You do not have any commandment in the Torah to actually wear a kippah. Everyone else says, oh, it's the origin of the kippah. There's a commandment somewhere in the Torah, etc. And then people try to compare themselves to the Kohanim, to the priests, that they were all like priests, were a holy nation, a nation of priests, and stuff like that. No, the answer is people who were in service in the temple, specifically the priests, they wore a head cover, which was part of – it wasn't a regular head cover. It was like a turban type of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was also very, very tall. So it wasn't something that was – prescribed to the entire people of Israel, was only given to the Kohanim. Mm-hmm. And the high priest had his own turban type of thing as well. A regular Israelite did not have to cover their head. Okay, you do not have to cover your head in any case, even when you pray, even when you walk into the temple, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So what is really the issue of covering your head? So it's very clear from the ancient world that people of authority, people in a high position in society, covered themselves up. And I mentioned this also when I spoke about the priestly garments at one point, that the more important you were, the more covered you were. This is why Aaron has eight pieces of clothing, and the regular priests have four. It has to do with the issue of the more important you are, the more you cover yourself up, mm-hmm. including your head. Mm-hmm. So who has to cover their head? Really, only the Kohanim, probably the king as well. But we do know that in the ancient world, and even today, when you go to the Arabs, or you go to the Druze, which are a group of people who come from the area of Syria, mm-hmm. The more important they are in society and the more important they are in the religion, the more elaborate the head cover is. But the average schmo doesn't have to cover the head. It's very interesting that the Druze, what they have is that if you become religious, you put on this little cap on your white cap with a pompon on it. That's the first head cover. Uh-huh. And then if you advance more, you get another head cover, and you have to wear another type of clothing. And when you wear you get more advanced, you wear another type of head cover, and then another type of clothing. Hmm. So that's really how it worked. Now, where did the kippah come from? So first of all, about a couple hundred years ago, it became the practice of religious people in Europe to wear a when I say religious people, I'm talking about also Christians, sure. to wear a head cap.
Because we see them now, in the Vatican, right? All the
you see, yeah, you
bishops and cardinals.
You look at the cardinals. Yeah. You look at, yeah, bishops and cardinals. And notice the fact that it's really bishops, cardinals, and then the Pope. Anyone underneath that doesn't wear such a head cover.
Hmm.
Okay, you don't have regular priests and people like that that actually
it's a status
cover
symbol.
Their heads.
It's a status Unless, symbol, right?
It's a status symbol. It's a symbol of also how religious you are and how important you are. Mm-hmm. I did see once a priest, and I think he was German. And it's very interesting that when I looked into it, a lot of the German preachers wore such caps. So it also something that developed separately in different groups that they developed different customs. Also, for example, when you go to the Ethiopian church, the lower-ranking priests wear one head cover, the higher-ranking priests wear another head cover, and I've also seen turbans. Some of the highest-ranking people in the Ethiopian Orthodox and Ethiopian Coptic church wear actual turbans, and I actually once saw a procession of them. So basically, there's no commandment in the Torah to wear a head cover. It's really something that became a symbol of being religious in the Jewish world. Sure. At a latter point.
And as, today, as you mentioned, most Orthodox. Sorry to interrupt, but as you mentioned, it came out of a European tradition, and it wasn't just religious people who wore a certain type of hat, but all different traditions were identified by their headwear. For example, one that continues to today is the chef's hat. Do you have a chef's hat?
I actually have several types, yeah.
There you go.
it depend on the position I was working in. Mm-hmm. When I was just a line cook, so I wore one head cover, which was basically some kind of a whatever kind of hat you put on your head. When I had to be more presentable, so I wore a white coat with a big tall hat. Yeah. It was a whole bunch of types of hats that you have. Yeah, you but it really depends. Also, it really also depends on the type of if you're a German chef, if you're an American chef. In American chefs, for example, unless they're in competitions and stuff like that, they don't really care about what their head cover is. But for example, in hotels, for example, if you go to a hotel in Europe, the chefs have to wear certain types of head covers. And the head chef usually wears because when he's running around in the kitchen, he doesn't cover his head. But when he has to go out and present something, he wears a very, very specific hat. Mm-hmm. Today people don't really understand the issue of uniform and wearing specific clothing. And really, covering your head today in Judaism is wearing all the time, to a point that, for example, in Chabad, they wear ones with little rubber bands to keep them on their heads when they go to sleep. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of ridiculous. They wear tzitzit when they sleep, and they wear kippah on their heads when they sleep, which is right? utter nonsense.
Wow.
But what you do have is today Jews, Orthodox Jews, wear head covers all the time. Mm-hmm. And when, for example, a Jew who's semi-religious or secular, when they go to a holy place or when they have to meet up with a rabbi or something, they cover their heads. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this done? So, first of all, it just became that when you're in a religious place, you cover your head and stuff like that, and that's really what happened. And I've seen in churches where they tell you to take off your hat. And I remember there was this whole thing. This guy who was a religious Jew, he was taken into a cathedral or something. So it was no longer really a church anymore. Mm-hmm. Because there's this practice not to walk into churches, so he allowed himself to go in, and he walks in, and then the guy in the entrance says, "You have to take your head cover off." And he said, "I'm Jewish, I have to keep this on." Mm-hmm. So he said, "Okay, you can leave it on." So it was actually very interesting for them that a religious Jew walks into a cathedral. So there's no prescription in the Torah to wear a head cover. It's a practice that developed in Europe and also spread to other areas. I mean, Jews were in communication with one another. So, for example, you find head covers in North Africa at one point, the kippah at one point, in Yemen, in Persia, in Iraq, everywhere. It suddenly became standard. Mm. But I did look into this, and really the thing was that rabbis covered their heads. Now, as I mentioned, when you go to meet a rabbi, you cover your head. Why? There's an entry in the Babylonian Talmud that talks about that when you sit in front of a rabbi and he's teaching you, you're supposed to cover your head. And there was a story there of a man that every time he never covered his head when he walked in front of rabbis. And they say, "Oh, that foolish man. He has no respect." And the guy and the rabbi turns around and says, "Oh, he's from such and such town. They have rabbis and elders coming out of your ears there. So they're used to not covering their heads." Why do you cover your head in front of a rabbi? Probably an analogy of the idea of like the priests, that they covered their heads when they're in the presence of God. A Kohen didn't have to cover his head if he wasn't in the temple. It was only when he was in service. So essentially, no, you don't have to cover your head. You can wear a kippah if you want to go, if you go into a service. I wear a kippah most of the time, unless I don't feel like it. It's really, when I was growing up, my father never insisted that we always wear a kippah. My father never insisted that he has to wear a kippah all the time. And I asked him about the history of this, and he was very informative about it. He said that originally, even religious Jews, when they walked around the street, they didn't necessarily cover their heads. So first of all, it used to be that people wore hats all the time. This was the culture of 100 years ago, 200 years ago, men wore hats, end of story. So people usually covered their heads in general. But when it became more and more common not to wear a hat, then there were questions to rabbis, do I have to cover my head? And the majority of the rabbis actually answered, you don't. And there's even an entry in the Mishnah Berurah, which is a more modern type of halachic book written by the Chafetz Chaim, which is very famous for his book about Lashon Hara, gossip and communicating with one another and telling, basically gossip, because there's different facets of the concept of gossip. But anyhow, he wrote a very lengthy book about this. And he writes in the entry there that he says, if a person wears a kippah or a head cover, but if they don't, when they enter a synagogue, they should cover their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know that, for example, if you go to synagogues in Europe, you can have a person who's completely, not totally Orthodox, and they still have a kippah rack inside the synagogue that when a person enters, they put a kippah on their heads. But during the day, they won't walk around with a kippah.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's a relatively new thing to wear a kippah all the time. And I don't think that you have to wear one.
Excellent.
I just think that today, if you come to Israel, it's kind of odd if you're wearing tzitzit and you're not wearing a kippah, because it's a very strong influence of trying to be more and more strict and inventing more and more things to do in life, and basically And then when the Torah tells you to do something, you kind of ignore it.
So you know, in Israel, though, because I did notice, you know, there's a lot of, not everyone's, of course, not everyone's wearing the black and white, of course, but a lot of people are wearing the tzitzit. But even if they're not wearing the tzitzit, it seems like it's more culturally patriotic to wear a kippah. Is that what it is? It's for the most part, it's a form of patriotism?
So, yeah, when you wear a kippah, even if, I don't say patriotism, but it's affiliating yourself with something. You know, you can have a person who's semi-religious, but because he's somewhat religious, he'll wear a kippah. This can be a person who, he doesn't really keep much. You know, he keeps a kosher home, but, you know, he might, you know, he doesn't really practice a lot of things, and he won't wear tzitzit and stuff like that, but he wears a kippah because it's a symbol of being religious. No, it's no longer the tzitzit and practicing Torah that symbolizes the fact that you're religious. It's the kippah. It's become like a, it's because it's something you put in your head, and it doesn't really get in the way, and it doesn't really bother you.
So let me ask you this question. If I was to wear, in Israel, if I was wearing a tzitzit, in fact, I was. When I was in Israel, I was mostly wearing a tzitzit, and I had a cap on. How would that be viewed?
No, people won't really think about that. Yeah. So he's religious in the story.
Okay.
It's not necessarily kippah. You know, for example, there's a rabbi in the old city. I remember he wore a hat and a suit and everything. For example, there's a rabbi who lives in the old city of Jerusalem, and I've seen him numerous times. He wears a hat and he wears a suit and everything, but underneath the hat, he doesn't wear a kippah. When he enters a house or enters the synagogue, he enters the school, he takes off the hat, he immediately pulls out a kippah out of his pocket and puts it on his head. So no one really thinks about that. Mm-hmm. You do have the people who want to insist on wearing a kippah plus a hat, and they put the kippah in a certain way. You can see they're wearing a kippah and a hat and a whole lot of nonsense like that. And, yeah. And really, I remember this rabbi, he's well in his 70s, and I asked him about this, and he said, yeah, you just have to wear a head cover, end of story. You know, if it's a hat or a kippah, who cares? Yeah. And this is an important rabbi.
Mm-hmm. My friend, thank you. I just, before we get on to, now, of course, we have to get on to 1 Samuel chapter. You know what I might do, Yoel? I might, maybe we'll make this part one, and part two is actually 1 Samuel chapter 18. We will get to that on Light of the Prophets. But before we sign off on this, I just want to let everybody know that before we started Light of the Prophets, I said to Yoel, hey, do you reckon we could just talk about this? And the reason why I'm saying that is because I'm just letting everybody know this is off the top of your head. This is just off the top of your head. All of this information that you make available to us is just off the top of your head, and I really appreciate you discussing these things. But I just wanted to let everybody know this just rolls out of off the tongue of Yoel. And just a reminder to everybody, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. That you can get on the page, like the page, and engage with the information there, and this is the kind of stuff that you'll be engaging with. So thank you, my friend, for sharing your knowledge.
You're welcome.
Very much appreciated. Now, Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo, 1 Samuel chapter 18. Fortunately, this is not a big chapter, Yoel.
Yeah, it's not a big chapter. This is why we could combine, you know, part one, part two this time.
Yeah.
Because you had to have a filler of sorts. And blame everything on Jono. Blame Jono for everything. By the way, you should know, I'm really thankful that last week's recording, you got out very, very quickly, because it was important. I guess they're getting emails from people like, what's going on with Light of the Prophets? We want to hear Light of the Prophets. What's going on? What's going on? And now you're like, it's not my fault. Jono went to Israel, and now he's suffering from Jerusalem syndrome.
I'm suffering from Jerusalem syndrome. And I'm also in holiday mode because I'm up in Queensland on the coast, so it's kind of nice. Any case. Here we go. I'm going to read it. Are you still there? You're experiencing some technical difficulties.
I am drinking my water.
Right. Can you do that? I'm going to start reading. Now, this is 1 Samuel 18. It says, now, when he had finished speaking, who? Now, before we go on, Yoel, when we finished chapter 17, you just made mention of the fact that the chapter placement here in the Christian translation is in the middle of a paragraph.
Yeah, it's in the middle of a paragraph. It goes for two more verses 57, 58. Mm-hmm. And then you have your chapter, but the paragraph actually starts on verse 57.
Okay, so just to let everybody know, the he who had finished speaking, obviously, is David. And he was speaking to Saul. And then it says, and this is a curious verse, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Okay, so how do you understand?
Oh, man, there's the stupid speculation of so many scholars about this. You know, really, what's the problem with a man loving another man as a dear brother and friend?
I have had such friendships, very, very, very close friendships where a mate of mine that you could tell anything to during my school years, my teen years, my early 20s, that you could tell absolutely anything to and confide in and know that he was a loyal, loyal friend and that you could confide with your deepest, darkest secrets and whatnot. I consider myself very, very fortunate to have had relationships like that with some very, very close mates, as we say here in Australia.
Exactly, exactly. So what does it mean, v'nefesh Yonatan nikshera b'nefesh David? There's like the bonds of love. Okay, the word kashar means to tie. So there's a bond of love in between them. Now the word love as well, v'yahavehu, okay? And he loved him. Mm-hmm. Is really just means that he appreciated the person. You know, when you say love in between men, it's not the same as love in between a man and a woman. Mm. Okay, it's a completely different type of idea. That when men love one another, it's a bond of covenant as well. Mm. And actually, Jonathan does something very interesting here because in verse I think it's verse 3. Of verse 3 or verse 4, he actually does an interesting act here where he gives away his clothing and his weapons. Mm. And actually, I know this as a fact to be an act of a covenant that one gives another person clothing and weapons, and that's how they make a covenant between them. So when you say to love someone, for example, you say you love God, you know, it says in the Shema, "Ve'avtai Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavecha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha ve'ahavta." It's a relative term. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a relative term. And David says to when Jonathan dies, says, you know, I loved you more than the love to women. You know, when he says to him, I love you more than the love of women, it indicates that this is a completely different type of love. This is not a love, you know, when you say you love a man like you love a woman, then you can claim, okay, there's something going on there. But here he says it's beyond the love of women. This is a very, very...
incredibly deep loyalty, right?
Exactly. So when you say the word love in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily mean love in the same way that we would say love in between men and women. There's actually a book that I studied when I was in high school called Chovat HaLevavot, The Duties of the Heart. And there's a no, it wasn't Duties of the Heart. It was another book. I can't remember what it's called now. Years ago. Mm-hmm. And the writer actually deals with the four types of love. And he talks about the love in between man and woman, a father and child, a man to his friend, and the love of man to God. Mm. And he says there are four types of love, and each one of them is a different type of idea. Mm. So a man to his friend, it's a covenant, it's an agreement that we help one another, that we're here to one another.
Sure.
You know, it says in the Torah, "Ve'ahavta le'racha kamocha," love thy neighbor as thyself, as some would translate. Mm. You know, and love means to care, to want to help one another. But here something happens to Jonathan. Jonathan is like, he's completely overwhelmed by this young man called David. You know, he's the son of the king, and he turns around and is like, you know, I'll follow you anywhere. Something happens. Jonathan, unlike his father, Jonathan recognizes something in David that is beyond, you know, he doesn't look at him and go, you know, it doesn't look at him as in the physical sense. He's looking at him and going like, well, this is way beyond a regular person. Mm. And when you have a very, very impressive person, and a person that you realize there's something special going on, that you actually want to be close to them because there's something
something
important about
because
them.
There's something
and that's probably what Jonathan recognized.
There's commonality, there's admiration, there's something he can relate to because, and I think I mentioned, and this is a mistake, that I think I said at the end of chapter 17 that we're introduced to two new characters, that being Jonathan and Michael. That's not true. We're introduced to... Two of Saul's daughters, which is mentioned later in the chapter. But Jonathan, of course, was mentioned earlier, and we see a similar sort of, and I think it's chapter 14. Let me just go back here. Yeah, it is. Jonathan defeats the Philistines in chapter 14, and we see the kind of courage, Jonathan taking the initiative. Yeah. And he probably
recognizes that God's with him. He goes like, okay, this is someone we can relate. We have very similar things.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's exactly what happened. And so it goes.
Yeah, so it says that Jonathan made a covenant with David for his love to him as he loved him as himself. Mm-hmm. And he takes off his me'il. Now the me'il, we've seen this word me'il before with Samuel. Now there is an opinion, there are two ways of looking at this. He's taking off his upper garment and he's taking his weapons and he's giving it to David also as a symbol of covenant, which was well attested in in some covenant treaties from the ancient Near East. Mm. But there's also this Mi'il. There's some contexts that say that in Ugaritic texts they mention a coat which was a special garment of the son of the king, of the prince, mm-hmm. and maybe even the crown prince. So by giving this, some people say, by giving this to David, Jonathan is basically forfeiting his position as crown prince.
That's very interesting.
And he's basically saying, you're going to be king. Now, here's an interesting idea, because we're going to see a verse later on where Saul says, and they might as well give him kingship over Israel.
Yes, he does.
And these are probably hints. So he's giving him his coat, which is a symbol of being the crown prince, and then his father himself says, "Oh, they just give him the kingship if you're already saying that."
That's verse 8. So he gets the verse 8, but he does. You're right.
So there are interior hints here that psychologically all the main characters here really started recognizing the fact that David's going to be king way before it actually happens. Mm-hmm. It's like as if they're the chosen people of God, and they're tapped into something and they're recognizing something, but they're saying it and they're not really knowing what they're saying. Or they're doing something and not really recognizing what they're doing. They don't really understand the implication of what they're saying and doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm, sure. Verse 5, so David went out whenever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And that's a phrase that we see a number of times, I think two or three times in this chapter, that he behaved wisely.
Yaskil wisely also means to succeed.
Right.
And what's very interesting, is that the word sechel, sachal, and sachal, and these are three words and they're all connected to the mind. Mm. So the word sechel means wisdom, thought, mind, brain. Then you also have the word yaskil, which means to succeed, but to succeed with wisdom. But if you change the word sechel to sachal, it also refers to someone being stupid,
so
ignorant.
Before you continue,
acting in a stupid way.
Before you continue, have you just walked outside into the? It sounds like you're experiencing some wind.
Oh, a wind suddenly started blowing. Stop in a second.
Okay.
What's wrong with a desert wind? You don't like you're discriminating against the wind.
I'm not discriminating against the wind. It's just tricky on the audio. Are you outside?
No, I'm in the house. It's just a wind suddenly blowed in. Let me close the window, you whiner.
Because we want to hear what you're saying with clarity.
Yeah, well, the place I'm moving to, there's less wind.
Is that right?
Yeah, much less wind. I actually have to buy air conditioners.
Ah, okay. But it's cooler up there. What are you talking about? It's cooler up there.
No, it isn't. It's stinking hot up there.
Well, it's because it's more humid.
Yeah, that's why I have to buy these more. No, we have to buy these more air conditioner units to keep the place cool.
That's right. Yeah, and now, yeah. Well, it goes on to say Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now, set him over all the men of war. What happened to Abner?
So it's a very good question. But Abner was basically the general. So he's part of the,
head of staff,
joint chief of staff.
Yeah.
And he's basically receiving another general into his army. What's also interesting is this word yaskil. In the English translation, it has to do something to do with wisdom. And really, yaskil has to do with the word sechel, which means a mind, a thought, a function of the brain. Mm-hmm. Now, what's very, very interesting is that you can take the word sechel, yaskil, they're from the same root. And then you have the word sachal, which is from the exact same root. But when someone's a sachal, it means someone who is acting in an ignorant way, someone who is stupid. So it's interesting that you take that one root and you can play with it in different ways. One means mind, and then two different ways of putting the vowel points. One would mean acting in a wise way and a successful way, and then one meaning acting in an ignorant way in a non-successful way, which is very, very interesting. So this is why vowel points are so important for the Hebrew Bible, because I keep on hearing this thing about the vowel points were invented by rabbis or something. No, they were not. They're part of a vocalization tradition that came down throughout the centuries, and the vowel points were positioned in later on.
Sure.
So he's actually placed over the men of war, and people actually like this.
So
the nation, the people were very, very pleased with this idea.
So it's fair. Is it fair to say then that at least David is now put into a position that is similar to that of Abner? And the thing that I found interesting in verse 6, Yoel, is that it goes on to say, now it happened when David was returning home, like he's coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, singular, that the women came out, from all the cities of Israel, and they were singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and joy and with the musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced, and they said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Now, I don't know why, but that's the first time I've ever noticed that this seems to be when he was returning from slaying Goliath. I always thought that this was, you know, I don't know why, but I had always read it as when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines, plural. But in chapter 17, we don't actually see David then chasing down the Philistines. We see him having killed Goliath, carrying around the head of Goliath. This is his trophy. The rest of the army seems to chase down the Philistines and destroy them. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'm just actually looking at it very, very quickly to make sure that you're right. And really, David takes down the Philistine, and that's basically it. So also, there's this whole back and forth. We're talking about what happens in general. We have basically an intervention here that the verse 5 starts with a vav, Vayetzeh David. So this is an intervening vav. It introduces something that happens, mm-hmm. but then now we're returning to the original storyline. We're back on track on the timeline. Mm-hmm. Now, when they return, all the women go out to sing, and it says v'hamecholot, and there's a bit of a obscure grammatical issue here, but it basically means that they went out dancing. Mm-hmm. But there are some sources that say that this the mecholot, because the mecholot was a type of musical instrument, but it probably was a type of dancing. Mm-hmm. And they're actually going out to greet King Saul. They're not greeting King David. They're going to greet King Saul. He's the important character. And with tambourines and joy and everything. And the women who were dancing were saying, now this is very, very interesting. There are women dancing around, which mm-hmm. is unheard of in Orthodox Judaism. And they're probably also singing. And they sing out an interesting rhythm where it says, Saul has strike 1,000 and David tens of thousands. Now, there's a misconception here regarding this. The idea of using 1,000 and 10,000 is a classic way of expressing a lot. Mm-hmm. 1,000, 10, you have, for example, you go to Psalm 91, you have that, Yipol mitzidcha elef uvavam yiminecha. You know, 1,000 will fall on your left hand side and 10,000 your right hand. This means a lot. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean specifically he struck 1,000, he struck 10,000. But also, it's a parallel. They're not saying that Saul has stricken down less than David. They're just creating a parallel. So it's kind of unfortunate that David receives the tens of thousands, but they mention Saul first because Saul is more important, and David is mentioned second. But because Saul hears the thousands and tens of thousands, he's focusing on that. He's not focusing on the idea that he's mentioned first, making him the more important. He's actually mentioned, he's focusing on the numbers. Mm. Now, again, it could be that, you know, Saul has fought several wars and he's beaten, he's never defeated such an enemy. And it was well known that it was David that went out where it was expected that Saul will go out. So maybe they are praising Saul, but they're actually saying that David is more important. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, because it's a specific type of parallel. You know, you have this dilemma. Who is more important? The king. So we should mention the king first. But, the rhythm usually goes 1,000, 10,000. They decide to stick to the rhythm and use the respect that was given to the king instead of giving him the number that should have been given to him as being the tens of thousands. Mm. But he focuses on this, and this really annoys him. This really gets to him to a point where he says that Vayichal le Shaul meod, and Shaul became very, very angry. Okay? That's an emotion. Vayira be'enav adavar hazeh. And this deed was evil or bad in his eyes, which is his thoughts. Mm. So his emotion comes up, and then he starts thinking about it, and it becomes an evil deed. It becomes a problematic deed in his eyes. So it makes him react emotionally and with thought. He's going like, okay, we have to do something about this now. This is bad. This is very, very bad for me.
And as you pointed out earlier on. Well, as you pointed out earlier on, he actually says in verse 8, now what more can he have but the kingdom? And so Saul, it says, so Saul eyed David from that day forth. He kept his eye on David from that
time. Okay, so it's very interesting. So first of all, yeah, it says, you see here, he says, you know, they gave David a tenth of thousand, they gave me thousands. He's not thinking about the parallelism. He's just angry. Mm. And as we just said, he gave him the kingship. Now it says, Vayi Shaul oyen et David. So the word oyen means to be an enemy. But it's very interesting that the English translation says he eyed him, because the word oyen here is written with a vav. And vav and yud can interchange because they're very, very similar consonants. Mm-hmm. One is longer, one is short in form. So some people may have recognized this in the Greek when they're translating into Greek. They thought it was a yud, so they said I'd. But it's the word oyen is also related to the issue of eye. So you look at someone in with an evil eye.
Mm-hmm.
Not evil eye as the witchcraft, but evil eye is meaning you're now suspicious of this person and you're eyeing them all the time. You're following them around. You're making mm-hmm. sure they know exactly what they're doing.
Sure. And so it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit, or the, now that's Ra, Ruach, right?
Ruach Elohim Ra'ah. It's a very interesting, instead of saying Ruach Ra'ah me Elohim, it says Ruach Elohim Ra'ah, a spirit of God, and then it gives you another word, a bad or an evil spirit from God.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Basically what it does is it gives him some kind of a psychotic episode.
Right. And but the weird thing about that is it goes on to say, well, that he prophesied inside the house. What?
Yeah, so it's a spirit from God.
Mm.
And again, you have to remember that in the ancient world, they didn't really always be able to recognize what is prophecy, what is madness. And here is the writer recognized that this is a punishment from God.
Mm-hmm.
But he's lying down there and he's having some kind of a psychotic episode where he's lying down there and he's probably behaving like some prophets would, where they just lie down and they start ranting and whatnot. And they recognize it as being some kind of spirit from God, but he's not prophesizing. He's going mad. But also, we know that Saul received a certain kind of prophecy earlier on. We had this very early in the storyline where we mentioned that people said, "Is Saul also from the prophets?"
Mm-hmm, true.
So they recognized that Saul had the ability for prophecy as well because he received prophecy in the past.
Sure.
But they also were able to recognize that this wasn't prophecy. This was a headache for him. And this is why they also mentioned that this was an evil spirit. By the way, when we use this very quickly about the terminology of prophecy, so a lot of people, when they say prophecy, they immediately think about prophets like, you know, Samuel or Isaiah or anything like that. But also prophecy was also a state of ecstasy,
mm-hmm.
which means a person receives the word of God, but it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't necessarily mean that that person is a prophet. It could, in a sense of like telling the people what's happening, it's a person that also reaches what some people would call a state of nirvana, a state of, you know, being connected to the spirit of God and, you know, just being connected and not receiving any actual words.
Can we use the word enlightened? Can we say that?
Maybe some kind of enlightenment, but the person is kind of like detached from this world and connected to the main source of energy, you would say. So the person is just, you know, he's in some kind of ecstasy, and this is why sometimes, you know, there was a whole thing about charismatic prophets, you know, people that weren't really prophets. What they'll do is, you know, to prove that there's a God, they'll just suddenly fall on the floor and shake around and, you know, and start talking gibberish or something like that. And that was recognized as a type of prophecy as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may not gibberish, but they'll say certain words. And it wasn't necessarily an issue of receiving the word of God. It was an issue of knowing that you can connect to God.
So potentially, Yoel, Saul, Shaul, may have been exhibiting such behavior. And though they knew it was an evil spirit, because it was by no means a pleasant thing, he's in a foul mood and he's acting like this, a distressing spirit, and he prophesied inside the house.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So they brought King David, as we know already. They brought David to play music in front of him. Well, and what's very interesting, the text tells us, is "Vechanit biyad Shaul," and the spear is in the hands of Saul.
So David in his hand is the instrument, in the hands of Shaul is the spear, and Saul casts the spear.
By the way, a spear in this case is probably a symbol of his kingship. You know, a king would have a scepter in his hand, and many kings, for example, in the northern kingdoms, you know, in Assyria and Babylon, the kings were sometimes shown as the authority of being a king had to do with the issue of holding a weapon in your hand. So this wasn't a javelin or something. This was a spear, which means it was also in a very, very long rod, which means that he's holding this thing, and it's a symbol of his kingship. So it wasn't weird that he's holding this. But you just made an interesting thing. King David is holding a musical instrument. That's the symbol of King David's kingship. And it actually was always recognized that the symbols of King David was either his staff that he was holding in his hand when he went to battle with Philistine, or the harp, the whatever type of musical instrument the nevel, the kinnor was. And it's a very, very interesting point that you brought up.
And so, because Saul says, "I'll pin David to the wall," and he threw it at him, but David escaped his presence. Now, this is what blows my mind, Yoel. David escapes his presence twice. I mean, it happened once, and he thought, "Yeah, so."
No, it doesn't say back. The Hebrew doesn't say escape. It means he turned. David was sitting there, and he suddenly turned to one side for some reason, and then okay, whatever, and then he turned to the other side. So also, you know, he didn't throw it at him because I don't know how far he is from him.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that he tried to thrust forward with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, it's a long rod, so he tried to stab him, and he suddenly moved, and it missed him, and he pulled it right back, and maybe David didn't notice it happened.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I didn't consider that at all, but I suppose that's a possibility. That's certainly plausible.
Yeah, so vayatel, I mean, usually vayatel means to throw, but it might be that the thrust forward, you know, if you've ever used a long rod as a weapon or actually a spear, there's also a thrusting forward, but you don't necessarily disconnect from it. Because really, when you're in a battlefield, for example, and this is one of your only weapons, because it used to, not everyone had a sword. So sometimes your point is to thrust forward with strength, and there's a way you use what's sometimes referred to as kinetic energy that you draw from the ground, and you thrust forward with this thing, but you don't necessarily throw depart. It at your enemy.
Yeah, it doesn't depart from you. I mean, if that's your only weapon, you want to use that again. And so potentially...
Yeah, throwing weapons were usually with a javelin, which were smaller. But if you're holding something which is like, for example, has a rod of like 5-6 feet long and you have a head on top of it, it's not a throwing weapon. It's a thrusting weapon.
Very good point. So Shaul was afraid of David because Yehovah was with him, but had departed from Shaul. Therefore, Shaul removed him from his presence and made him captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people, and David behaved wisely.
Wait, there it is again. So there's a point here that the demise of Saul and the rise of David. Yep. But there's also an interesting thing here. So he gets rid of him. He sends him out to the open field. He sends him out to be a regular general. And also it says, Vayitzeh vayavol lifneam, and he came out and back before the people. And the Yitzeh vayavol, it's very interesting that this is basically a term. These two words work as a term for someone who's a leader. And we actually have this term. It shows up as well in Numbers 27, verses 16 and 17, where it says that Moses turns around to God and says, please find someone to be the one who brings out and forth and brings back for the nation, basically a leader. So he's made him some type of a leader. So basically Saul is kind of like digging his own grave. He's giving David the positions that give him power.
I know.
Who's more interesting? Who's more important? A person who's up somewhere in office delegating what to do? Or someone who's actually out in the field, the real hero that goes out and fights the wars and does everything for people?
I know. And, you know, I thought about that because politically he really has no choice but to do this because, as he mentioned before to Samuel, he said, because I feared the people, you know, I did what they wanted. Remember when he said that in regards to bringing back the spoil of the Amalekites? And he says, because I fear the people. He still fears the people, I think, and that's the reason why he's elevating David. But at the same time, he's got his eye on him thinking, I'd really rather you just go away altogether.
Yeah, so this is the thing that gets in his way. He's putting his putting his personal issue here, and what he's really doing is he's setting the stage for David to become king.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so now it says again, verse 14: David behaved wisely in all of his ways, and Yehovah was with him. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, that's the third time, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went, as you say, he went out and he came in before them. Okay.
Also, a very interesting thing, and you see this along the book of Samuel, Israel and Judah. Oh, there's already, we're starting to see a distinction between, that used to do Israel and Judah.
I didn't pick that up.
It happens a lot in the book of Samuel.
That's a really
good point. It happens a lot because, first of all, the writers here are probably Judean, so they have a lot of like, you know, pride of being Judean. Okay, but it's very interesting. The book of Samuel, you see that, and we're already seeing this whole thing about being the Judeans versus Israel as echoes of the battles of what's going to happen later on, where Judah followed the king of Israel, followed David. It could be a whole thing about hinting what happens in the future. We have to remember that Judah continues to be loyal to David while the northern kingdom breaks off. And even before the breaking off of the northern kingdom, we also have this whole dispute when, for example, Absalom goes to war against his father, or the descendants of the house of Saul go against David, that Israel follows them, and Judah follows David. which is an interesting indicator. But this is also might be some level of polemic against the Northern Kingdom later on, that they have Judah, which are the loyal ones, and then you have Israel, who are disloyal to the king, to the chosen king of Israel.
Very good.
That might be part of it.
Excellent point.
That might be part of it.
Excellent point. It didn't occur to me at all, so thank you for that. So I reckon we're going to have to call it quits there, because we've been going on for some time. I think we have to leave the latter half of 18 till next week, and the latter half is, of course, the two daughters of Saul, because in chapter 17, Yoel, Saul does promise, and David does qualify a number of times before he goes out and kills Goliath. He says, "What shall be done for the man who kills this uncircumcised Philistine?" And one of the promises was that that Saul would give his daughter to be married to the person who does so.
Yeah, and which is a very, very important position back in the ancient world. Now you relate it to the royal family, so it's a big thing to be married to the daughter of the king.
But it's not as simple as that, and we'll find out why next week as we continue in chapter 18. We've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo on Light of the Prophets. Just a reminder to everybody, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. Please go to Hebrew in Israel, the Facebook page, and like it and engage with the information there. Thank you again, my friend. And HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com if you want to get on the waiting list. I can hear Prince Halevi IV laughing in the background. If you want to get on the waiting list to have quality Hebrew lessons with this very knowledgeable man, thanks again, my friend.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I also want to wish my wife a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Mrs. Halevi. In the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.